Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, Hurricane Katrina has plowed through the city of New Orleans with howling winds and blinding rain. Some homes in the city, which is below sea level, have been flooded to the ceilings. One city resident pleading for help told Associated Press via cell phone that the water was rising fast. He had a hammer and an axe and a crowbar, but he was holding off breaking through the roof until the last minute. He asked for someone to come and save him. There are also reports out of New Orleans suburbs of buildings collapsing. Part of the roof of the Superdome, where thousands of people have taken shelter, has peeled away, but officials say that facility is not in any danger. Well, Gulfport, Mississippi is now in Katrina's path. We spoke with freelance producer Cornelius Greenway moments ago. He is in Gulfport, Mississippi. Along with other residents, he's completely cut off from any news and any city officials, so we asked him, what's he seeing?
Well, we've had wind gusts up to about 150 miles an hour. But the issue here right now is the water, the rising water. We're about, say, about 600 yards from the actual beach in the United States Naval Retirement Facility in Gulfport, Mississippi. And the water has actually overtaken the first floor of the building. It's knee-high in the first floor of this building. Everybody that's been on the first floor had to be evacuated. Most people are retired. And are in wheelchairs, and staff here has been excellent and getting everybody up and safe. And winds are terrible, but the water is the big issue right now.
Right. In fact, your fire chief there in Gulfport, Pat Sullivan, is quoted as saying that boats have gone into buildings, lots of downed trees. He says we're looking at Camille 2. Can you compare this to anything else?
I worked through Hurricane Andrew, which later was determined to be a Category 5. Mm-hmm. I can tell you this looks very, very similar, although we didn't have the strong surge that these guys seem to have right now. But we will know like a few days from now what the total impact
right.
of this storm.
But in other words, this is big. And as you watched it approach, I mean, we understand that it sort of wobbled a little bit, veered slightly away from New Orleans and towards you guys in Mississippi.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was telling somebody here at the home that I would wish for the storm to come towards us, because I really didn't want it to go towards New Orleans, knowing what could happen there.
Well, good for you. Tell us, by the way, there's a U.S. 90 in Mississippi. That's a major coastal route where the casinos are. And where are you in relation to that in Mississippi, in Gulfport?
The road that, if you're talking about the road that's actually on the water, that's the coastal route, that is totally underwater right now. It's totally impassable.
We understand sailboats are up on U.S. 90.
Surprised that they're not even further inland, because we have lost all our vehicles at this facility, and we're supposed to be 30 feet above sea level here.
Right. And so, again, how far are you from U.S. 90?
At least 400 yards, right on the water.
Right on the water and underwater, as you're saying. So what are you being told? What are city officials telling people? Has the city been evacuated?
To my knowledge, yes. I had a chance to go out this morning before the storm hit, like about 7 a.m., and there was nobody out on the streets. Jesus. Just almost got hit by a big piece of glass.
I heard that.
Here. I'm standing behind bulletproof glass, and there's impacts in it, like if somebody took shots at it.
So something hit the glass?
Yes, this is part of the building windows that are breaking off. As we speak, the higher up, of course, the stronger the wind.
Well, we certainly want you to be as safe as possible. Why are you there? I mean, are there people who have gone to shelters? Did you choose to stay there instead?
No, we were actually nearby at another location trying to do some work, and people from this facility saw us and invited us to actually come here, and we saw this was a very safe place to actually do some work and be protected.
Right, well, except stay away from that window. Well, Cornelius, again, what are city officials saying further? Are they, you know, telling people to evacuate? Or
we haven't had any contact with any city officials right now. Anybody that would decide to go out in the streets would be, you know, wishing for their death, because anything that hits you at this wind speed could go right through you. When I go out with a Kevlar vest and a helmet, and I still use buildings to actually protect me. Mm. So I wouldn't say it would be very smart to actually try to move in any direction right now. People should stay in their house and try to do their best to stay safe and stay away from the windows.
Freelance media producer Cornelius Greenway is in Gulfport, Mississippi, writing out Katrina. Cornelius, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to keep an eye on Katrina over the course of the program, including a check-in with the National Weather Service that's coming up. But for now, as many Americans know, most Americans know, there is a political storm raging as well. And it centers on whether the U.S. should stay in Iraq or pull out. This weekend, President Bush praised the Iraqi draft constitution as a milestone, but the document was presented to the Iraqi National Assembly yesterday without the agreement of the minority Sunnis, thousands of whom took to the streets to protest. And anxiety over Iraq is growing in the U.S. Congress, to the point that Republican John Warner, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, says he will call Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to testify when Congress returns from summer break next week. So, stay or go. Joining us here in the studio is Andrew Basevich. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University, a retired Army colonel. He recently argued in the pages of the Washington Post that the president should call it a day in Iraq, and he joins us here in the studio. Doctor, welcome.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
And joining us on the phone, Fred Kagan. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and expert on military history. He recently wrote Stay the Course, Mr. President, in the Los Angeles Times. And Dr. Kagan, welcome to you as well.
Hi there.
So two reasoned and opposing opinions reflecting a lot of Americans. But let's hear those opinions briefly. Dr. Kagan, let's start with you first. Could you briefly sketch out your argument? You say the U.S. should stay the course, and it's not as bad as it seems. Could you elaborate?
Well, I think in the first place, we have to look for a moment at what the consequences of leaving would be. And when you do that, I think you see that they are horrific and unacceptable. Iraq will immediately descend into chaos, almost certainly civil war. And you will have created a country of 25 million people with oil revenue, full of scientists who have been engaged in weapons of mass destruction programs, and now a vast safe haven for terrorists. I can't imagine anyone looking at that situation and deciding that that's acceptable.
And you also write that those insurgents in Iraq that do exist are not nihilists, you write. I mean, tell us further why that's important to you.
Well,
or are nihilists, rather.
No, they are nihilists.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
The issue is that the insurgency right now actually has very little to offer most Iraqi people. It's a very negative insurgency. It doesn't have a positive message. And it means that it's going to be very unlikely that the insurgents are going to be able to draw a lot of the Iraqi people over to their side enthusiastically, because of their message.
Well, Dr. Basevich, a recent AP Ipsos poll showed that 53% of Americans think that going to Iraq was a mistake, but 60%, a majority, agree in part with Dr. Kagan. They believe the U.S. must stay the course now that we're there. You disagree with that. Why?
Well, my argument is that we've accomplished all that we can expect to accomplish in Iraq. Indeed, we probably accomplished all we could expect to accomplish when we overthrew the Ba'ath regime, and that their expectations of creating a new liberal democratic order probably are beyond our capability. You know, the military, the U.S. military, for all practical purposes, has acknowledged that the war is unwinnable in a military sense. They have said explicitly that we need to find a political solution, meaning a political way out. So my argument is that if we stay the course, all we're doing is running up the costs that we're already paying. Indeed, we're probably exacerbating Iraqi instability by our very presence, whereas getting out allows us to focus on priorities that, in my judgment, are actually more important. Mm-hmm. That is to say, getting serious about thinking through what we should do with regard to the radical Islamist threat. One of the places where I think Fred and I differ is he is certain that he knows what's going to happen if we pull out, that chaos will ensue. I would certainly acknowledge that's a possibility, but I would argue that there are other possibilities, that indeed by us getting out of the way, we may in effect concentrate the minds of Iraqis and of others in the region who will come to understand what would be the implications of disintegration of the Iraqi state.
So
again,
no
guarantees either way, but I think that there are positive alternatives that could come out of withdrawal. There are no positive results out of staying the course.
Well, so there we are in the two corners that many Americans are in. Dr. Kagan, just your response. You said you felt withdrawal would lead to chaos. Many Americans agree. Dr. Bacevich is saying staying will lead to more chaos, and withdrawal might not mean chaos. Your thoughts?
I think that we disagree on something else as well, which is that I think Andy is seeing a dichotomy between the political function and the military function, which I don't see. I think that our presence in Iraq is much less of an irritant than it is a force for stability, because if we pull out or make it clear that we're going to pull out, we're also making it clear to the Sunnis that there is likely to be success for them in a violent path. If we make it clear that we're determined to stay and fight violence, then we have the prospect, and of course nothing is certain, of making it clear to the Sunnis that the only hope that they have of making their lot better is by participating in the political process. So I actually think it's very unlikely that there will be positive political progress if we abandon the military fight.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, what about that thinking? And we're hearing other analysts say that the withdrawal could be interpreted in different ways, and they're pointing to the Middle East, the withdrawal from Gaza, which, of course, Israel points to as a strategic move. But this weekend, we saw Hamas claim it as a victory. There is the fear that the same will be done by al-Qaeda, which was not in Iraq prior to the war and is now, that they will claim a withdrawal by the U.S. as their victory.
And they almost certainly would. And we really cannot dictate or determine what al-Qaeda is going to say. On the other hand, if we stay, al-Qaeda also has things to say. If we stay the course, they insist that we are an occupying force, not a liberating force, as we claim. They say that we're there so that we can control oil, the resources that rightly belong to the Iraqi people. Now, we deny that, but to the extent that we stay on, we certainly are also arming them with rhetorical clubs that they can use to beat us up. So either way, they're going to have things to say. There is no clean, painless option available here. I mean, the war was a mistake in the first place, and it cannot be undone. We need to look to our interests, and it seems to me that our interests lie in trying to find ways to liquidate this heavy obligation that we are bearing.
Dr. Kagan, I want to get a brief thought from you because we're about to take a break. You've argued that Secretary Rumsfeld should resign. Can you just briefly, in the few seconds we have, leave us food for thought? Why?
I think that he has fought this war as though it were a second-order priority, and I think that he's been too focused on military transformation. Among other things, I think he's therefore starved the military of the troops that it needs to fight the war properly in the first place and now to pursue the insurgency.
I'm going to hold you up there. Fred Kagan, military historian with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Andrew Bacevich, a professor of international relations at Boston University. Having the dialogue that many Americans have, raising the question, should we stay or should we go in Iraq? When we come back, is there a third way? Is there middle ground? Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Continue to update you on Hurricane Katrina. It's pummeling the coast along the Gulf of Mexico, flinging boats onto highways in Mississippi. It's flooded roads in Alabama. And though reduced from a Category 5 to a 4, New Orleans is not in the clear. The rains there could still flood that city, which is below sea level. We'll follow the story for you. But right now we're continuing our conversation with two military experts about whether the U.S. should stay the course in Iraq or pull out. Joining us on the phone is Fred Kagan. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute Institute. He recently argued, "Stay the course, Mr. President," in the LA Times. And we're joined in the studio by Dr. Andrew Basevich. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. And he recently wrote in the pages of the Washington Post that the president should call it a day in Iraq. And Fred, Dr. Kagan, you had just said that you wanted to call for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. You don't feel that he's made the war in Iraq a priority, starving the resources. And if you don't mind, Dr. Basevich would like to respond to that. Go ahead.
Well, I'd probably recommend firing Secretary Rumsfeld for different reasons. But, I mean, on the point of resources, if you believe that the war is winnable, again, I don't. But if you believe the war is winnable militarily, then it seems to me that the critique that Rumsfeld has failed to resource it properly has great merit, that instead of having 130,000 troops there, we should have, let's say, 250,000 troops. The problem with Fred's argument that we should now fire Rumsfeld is that even if you did today and put in a let's-go-win-the-war replacement, it would be at least 2 years before the U.S. military could generate those additional resources. I mean, you can't create units overnight of the sort of quality that we would want to have.
Well, Fred Kagan, I want to jump in there. Do you think the war is winnable? Fred Kagan, who says stay the course.
I continue to think that we make a false dichotomy here by talking about winning the war militarily. No insurgency is won militarily. I do believe that we can defeat this insurgency and establish a stable regime in Iraq.
Well, to borrow a phrase, you talk about the false dichotomy. Is there a third way? Democratic Senator Russ Feingold says President Bush has presented a false choice between staying and going. Perhaps we are as well. That has silenced any legitimate debate over other alternatives, such as one that's bouncing around to pay off the Sunni insurgents. Fred Kagan, do you think there is a third way?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, you either have troops in Iraq or you don't have troops in Iraq, and we can talk about the force levels some, but that really is a dichotomy. That's not a false one. That's the way that it is, and I don't think there's any getting around that.
But, well, you know, there's been a lot of people trying. Last week in the Washington Post, General Wesley Clark, former Democratic candidate for president, wrote that the U.S. wasted the first year in Iraq, but it would be a mistake to pull out now. He's arguing for a diplomatic solution alongside a military one. Andrew Basevich.
I really think the argument, although the president speaks of showing resolve, it seems to me that the real argument is between those who want to stay on because they think we can prevail, like Fred, and all those who think that we cannot prevail and who are having a lesser argument about the terms under which we will pull out. I mean, my sense is that the Bush administration, in fact, is engaged in lowering expectations about what it can achieve and is beginning to lay the groundwork for a withdrawal. Now, the administration's plan, if there is such a thing for withdrawal, probably looks to this process unfolding over a period of 2 or 3 years. I'd probably like to see that process happening within about a year. Mm. But it seems to me that really the dichotomy is between those who still think that we can have this thing turn out to be rosy and those who know we can't and are trying to figure out the best way to extricate ourselves.
Well, and Fred Kagan, I wouldn't put you on the rosy side necessarily, but you do say in your article, Stay the Course, Mr. President, in the LA Times, that this is not as bad a situation as we're hearing. Now, you mentioned just a few moments ago one thing you see, which is that these insurgents are mostly nihilists who don't really care about the population as opposed to other groups which have provided services for a population. What else do you see that's positive?
Well, I think militarily we need to recognize that this is an insurgency at a very low level of military capability. This is fundamentally a widespread terrorist campaign, and it is not fundamentally a guerrilla war. And that makes it markedly different in the military aspect from what we saw in Vietnam. I also think that we have, despite the current controversy over the charter, I think we have a much wider spread commitment among the Iraqi people to trying to make this work in some way than we have seen in previous unsuccessful insurgencies. And I really think that we need to ask ourselves, what would success look like? And I think we've always been deluding ourselves that, and I think the Bush administration unfortunately has been helping with this, that there was a smooth road to this that was going to look nice pretty much most of the way. And that is, if we do succeed here, it's not going to look that way. It's going to look unpleasant for a long time, but that doesn't mean that it's not ultimately going to work out.
Well, columnist E.J. Dionne, and everybody's weighing in on this, recently wrote about the former Australian Defense Minister Kay Beazley, who proposed what Dionne called an electrifying idea at a recent conference. He likened it to what President Nixon did during Vietnam, a phased extraction from Iraq while shoring up the war on terrorism, a separate war, elsewhere, redeploying troops to the Syrian and Iranian borders. What do you think of that?
I think that would be folly. I think the biggest problem is not cross-border operations, and I think as soon as you say withdrawal, you are giving up on the prospect of positively influencing the situation in Iraq, and you're putting yourself in the position that Andy took earlier of hoping that things will work out with any great degree of control or confidence that they will.
And I'm going to hold you up there and give Dr. Bacevich the last 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm just impressed by the notion that the argument that we have to stay is one that at root assumes that the Iraqis are incapable of handling their own destiny. And I think that's false. And indeed, I think to the extent that we continue to take this sort of paternalistic approach, that it is simply counterproductive.
That's Dr. Andrew Bacevich, director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. We also spoke with Fred Kagan, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, about a topic Americans are talking about more and more, making strange bedfellows, strange adversaries, Iraq, stay or go. Thank you both for giving us some more thought about it today.
Oh, thank you.
And stay with us. That other storm, Katrina, will have coverage for you when we come back. Katrina's powerful wind and rain is still pummeling New Orleans. In one part of downtown, water covers the first floor of many buildings, and off-ramps from Interstate 10 resemble boat ramps leading into a lake. While the worst of the storm has missed New Orleans, the city is still in danger of flooding. And joining us now is Robert Kelly, director of the forecast operations at the National Hydrometeorological Prediction Center in Camp Springs, Maryland. And Robert, how much rain is New Orleans going to get?
Well, New Orleans... Already it's moving on past New Orleans as far as the worst of it, but they have had at least 6 to 10 inches in that area already, and they're still getting some more. So I would say that although the broader area can expect all through southeast Louisiana, generally speaking, 8 to 10, I would say New Orleans will get at least that much.
And do you know what that means? I mean, obviously the early fears were of storm surges and water crashing over the levees around New Orleans, which is like a big soup bowl. And if the water filled this big soup bowl of a city, the fear was it wouldn't get out. Can the kind of rain that's falling fill the city, or is that not as much of a fear?
Well, of course. I don't know if the rain could fill the city. They do have a series of levees, of course, to keep storm surge out as much as possible. And they don't have very good drainage in New Orleans because of its low-lying nature. They have to pump the water out. So this kind of rain would cause serious problems even without the storm surge. Now, they do have a system for pumping the water back out into the Gulf. Looking at the river forecasts, the River Forecast Center in Slidell is forecasting record flooding on both the Pascagoula and the Pearl Rivers, which are very near the New Orleans area over in Mississippi and southeast Louisiana. So the rainfall is going to have a serious impact on that whole region.
And as we've said, the worst has passed, but where is...
For the city of New Orleans,
right.
It's currently moving. The center of the Katrina is between New Orleans and Biloxi, and it is moving north at about 16 miles an hour, which is a very good sign. The further north it goes, the faster it'll go. And it was moving slowly across the Gulf, but it's showing an increasing forward speed. And that's really what you hope for when you're concerned with the heavy rainfall, that the faster it moves, the less amount of rain will accumulate.
Robert Kelly with the National Hydrometeorological Prediction Center. How, as storms go, unusual is Katrina? I mean, last week there was fear that this was going to happen, and then over the course of several days, it did build up. It was heading towards New Orleans this morning and then wobbled a little. How unusual is it?
This was a very big storm. I don't know in the total ranking of all hurricanes where it'll fit, but I believe it'll be in the top 10 to 15 as far as powerful hurricanes hitting the United States. It was an enormous storm. It was very powerful. The winds were very strong. The rain, of course, has been heavy. Fortunately, it's moving quickly. We've had some others that were weaker that produced more rain because they were slow. But as this was moving across the Gulf, it moved over very warm water in the northern Gulf of Mexico, and the eye expanded and grew larger, and the broad band of hurricane force winds really expanded significantly all the way well into the Florida panhandle. So this has been an unusual one. It's been very large and very strong, both.
If it had taken a direct hit on New Orleans, would the predictions you think have been valid about the damage it might have done?
Oh, wow. You know, that's really not my area of expertise. Oh. Probably FEMA or the local emergency preparedness people know a lot better what potential damage could have happened. We can just say that based on what we know of hurricanes, that this is a very powerful and a very dangerous storm. And I'm glad they started evacuations as soon as they could. And there's really no way to guess when you have such a rare event just how bad it might be.
Right. And just briefly, you say heading towards Mississippi, and we wouldn't hold you to it, but what do you expect in the next day or so?
Well, it's moving north. It's going to take a long time before it really diminishes. They will probably have hurricane force winds into the northern half of Mississippi even. And they can expect approximately 8 inches of rain as it goes through Mississippi. It will, by the time it gets into Tennessee, you'll start to see the rainfall amounts diminishing, primarily because it will be moving faster, and of course it won't have the Gulf of Mexico for support any longer. But it will, we think, run through the state of Mississippi, then through Tennessee and Kentucky, heading up to the eastern Great Lakes, actually. This doesn't look like one that's going to really hurt New England, but it is going to produce a fair amount of rain all the way through just on the eastern side of the Mississippi, up through the Tennessee River Valley, Ohio River Valley, and then into the eastern Great Lakes.
Robert Kelly, National Hydrometeorological Prediction Center. Robert, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure.
And joining us now on the line from NPR station WRKF in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Karen Henderson. She's the station's news director. And Karen, I know you're not in the eye of the storm. You did lose power earlier today. How's the area weathering this? And how far are you from New Orleans?
We're about an hour and a half.
Yeah. So that's a good distance, but we know you got battered a bit. What was it like?
Well, as you mentioned, we lost power earlier this morning. We've lost power several times, actually. Mm. And what we're experiencing is a lot of wind. And then with that wind, branches coming down, trees tumbling over and hitting power lines. So right now, that's the main concern. We're being warned not to go out and try to move around because of this, the danger of power lines down, and we're getting quite a bit of rain as well, so there's also the concern of flooding.
Well, blowing into the city along with the wind, residents of New Orleans who were evacuated to Baton Rouge, where were people staying? I mean, how is the city handling that influx?
Well, the city is what happens in these kinds of situations. People open their hearts, they open their homes. Several churches have opened their doors. The Red Cross has set up shelters. We have about 22 shelters open right now, about 5,000 people in these shelters, majority of them from southeast Louisiana, many of them from the New Orleans area. And it really was a steady stream all day yesterday, and the Interstate 10 heading out of New Orleans completely packed. And many of the people finding they didn't find hotels here in Baton Rouge. Our hotels are full. Some people had to go as far as Texas before they could find a place. And again, shelters here open, but even some of those filled to capacity.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, how far above sea level are you there in Baton Rouge?
Oh, and that's a question I should have an answer to and don't at this moment. I know we're much higher than
much
New
higher
Orleans,
than New Orleans.
Everybody pretty much is.
And I know that you are all holding your breath. It's very hard right now to get images out of New Orleans, phone calls, phone lines, everything down there. It must be tough to wait out to see the damage.
Well, you know, many of us, we're only an hour and a half away. I have family members there, many of the staff, and you know people there, you visit there. And so to see the pictures of the people that are there at the Superdome, the shelter of last resort, we're hearing that there's been a breach in the roof of that area. Of course, we're concerned about that. We're told it's not a dire situation, but rain is actually coming into that area. So, of course, you know, we hate to hear what family and friends and the people we love and know are experiencing there in New Orleans.
Of course. Well, thanks for speaking with us.
Karen, thank you, Robin.
Karen Henderson, news director at NPR's WRKF in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Karen, thanks. And still to come, what effect will Katrina have on gas prices? You're listening to Here and Now. Well, gas prices are at a record high, and as we're going to see, Katrina is not going to help. So car owners are looking at ways to get more mileage for their buck, or $2.63 to be exact. But could the answer be within the car itself? A professor in California thinks so. For decades, he's been tinkering with standard hybrid cars, creating plugged-in hybrids that get up to 250 miles to the gallon on just one tank of gas after being plugged into a wall outlet overnight. It's not something that hybrid car makers are encouraging. An engineer at Toyota says that plug-in hybrids are just not feasible yet. Some say they're dangerous, but they're feasible to Andy Frank, professor at UC Davis. He's on the line. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And walk us through this. First of all, how in general terms, remind us, how do regular hybrids work? And so how do your souped-up versions work in contrast to that?
Right. The regular hybrids are fundamentally more efficient gasoline cars. They don't use any electricity from the wall. They cannot be plugged in.
And but how are they hybrids?
Well, they use a combination of electricity and gasoline, but the electricity that they use is generated by gasoline.
Okay, it collects the energy that is produced by running a car.
That's right. So what we're doing is taking that same technology, but adding a much bigger battery pack and charging the battery using electricity from the wall.
More electricity than you would get if you just used the electricity produced by running the car.
That's right. It's like being able to buy gasoline at 50 cents a gallon. That's one way to measure it. The other way is to say when you're using both electricity and gasoline, your gasoline fuel economy greatly increases it to as high as 250 miles per gallon.
Well, and by the way, that's the high, but what is the average miles per gallon that you get with a plug-in as opposed to a hybrid?
The regular plug-in will get double the fuel economy of a conventional car, whereas the regular hybrid would get about 30 to 40% better.
Right. Well, if this is such a good idea, why aren't car companies doing it?
Well, fundamentally, the car companies are dragged kicking and screaming into the hybrid market. They're only doing the hybrid market because they're losing market share to Japan.
Well, as you know, there's been some criticism. One of the criticisms, it's not safe to plug into these batteries. They can explode. And that modifying the car in the way that you're doing it actually burns a lot of coal, so it is as polluting.
That's completely incorrect. And we've done very careful studies. First of all, we generate electricity in this country by coal, of course. However, overall, half the electricity that we use coming out of the wall is nuclear, water, and natural gas. And those sources of energy is much less polluting than what you can possibly get out of your tailpipe.
What about the safety questions about plugging into a big battery?
Well, you know, it's just like everything else. If the car companies were to build these cars, all safety issues would be answered.
By the way, how many tinkers do you think there are, this sort of underground?
Well, there are probably hundreds.
Huh. You know, we go back to the question, why aren't more car companies doing it? Do you think there are other reasons? I mean, right now, the money, literally, is being placed on hydrogen cars.
Yeah, well, if you notice the amount of money being spent by the car companies now just to sell their big SUVs, if you look at that amount of money and compare it to how much is being spent on the so-called hydrogen economy, it's the hydrogen economy is dwarfed by the advertising.
So, you know, obviously, you know, you and others feel there's some politics to it, but I want to make sure to be clear here, Professor, because while a lot of people say you're onto something, I'm sure you wouldn't want people to just get an extension cord and a pair of, you know, double A's and go out to the garage.
It's a little more complex than that because the batteries that we're talking about are new batteries that will essentially last the lifetime of the car. It's not anything like the batteries that are currently in our car.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long ways from production. When these car companies have to make a major commitment towards that production, their incremental costs will be about 20% more. Equivalently, it would be like buying a car without the sunroof and leather seats and maybe the fancy stereo.
Or you could look at it as the amount of money you're going to save on gas.
Yes.
UC Davis Professor Andy Frank is one of those who has experimented with plug-in hybrids. Professor Frank, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. The path of Hurricane Katrina as it plows its way through Louisiana and Mississippi. The storm's been downgraded to a Category 3. Officials now saying the worst of it has passed New Orleans, but there are still worries about flooding. We turn now to Mark Schlesting. He's a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And Mark, what are you seeing there?
Well, looking out our window, we're still seeing moderately high winds. I think it's down to, you know, maybe tropical storm force winds, 45 miles an hour or something like that. Still a lot of rain. The reports that we're getting are that there is some flooding in the city in certain areas along the lakefront and in eastern New Orleans, down a bit south from the city in St. Bernard Parish. Apparently there is significant flooding that did catch some people in their homes. We're still trying to get a handle on that. The wind damage we're really unclear about. We know of a building that collapsed in the French Quarter, and of course a piece of the roof blew off the Superdome, mm-hmm. which was being used as a refuge of last resort.
I know you're right in the middle of the storm, so it's hard to assess, but it sounds as if we haven't heard of fatalities at least.
Well, I have the feeling that there will be some fatalities. I don't have anything confirmed. I know that there were three reported last night as a result, sort of semi as the result of the evacuation. Mm-hmm. There were three people from a nursing home
that's right.
who were on a bus for a while.
In transport.
For too long. And unfortunately, that has happened in the past as well because of the lengthy period of time it takes for these evacuations to work.
Mark, just a few seconds, but so far, can you compare it to anything? Is this the worst, or did not have the punch it said it would?
It's certainly not the worst case scenario. The question is whether or not it's as bad as a Hurricane Betsy that occurred in 1965.
And you'll find out when you get out.
Based on what we know now, it doesn't look like it, but it's really too soon to tell.
Mark Schlesting is a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Thanks for speaking with us, Mark.
Sure, no problem.
And as Katrina continues to pound the Gulf Coast, the price of crude oil is experiencing a storm surge of its own. Today, the price of crude oil futures surged past $70 a barrel for the first time ever as the offshore oil and gas rigs and refineries based in the Gulf of Mexico were shut down due to the storm. Peter Butel is president of the energy risk management firm Cameron Hanover. So, Peter, what kind of impact is Hurricane Katrina already having on the price of gas?
Right now, we're up about 18 cents. It does look like that will be passed along very quickly to the consumers by this Labor Day weekend.
You're saying 20 cents a gallon more to gas by this weekend?
It looks that way. Our big concern right now is that refineries may go down for a prolonged period of time. We do have about 1.8 million barrels a day of refinery production shut in right now on a precautionary basis, but our fear is that could be translated into something longer term.
Can you explain further the role of refineries? Why is that so important?
Well, we have plenty of crude oil. The problem is turning it into refined products like gasoline, heating oil, diesel, and jet fuel. Every single refinery unit in the United States, not just the refinery, but every unit within that refinery is critical right now to our supply of refined products. We don't burn crude oil here. We use gasoline, heating oil, diesel, etc. So we have to run it through the refineries. Even last week and the week before, any unit going down at any refinery was enough to make this market jump. For us to have seven or eight full refineries down and to lose that production even for a couple days is a major factor here. We just do not have the supply cushion to make it through that. Now, obviously, our big concern is that if we have flooding or if we have power outages and we can't get these units or these refineries back quickly, and even worse, should we have any permanent damage, we could have a very, very serious supply problem.
But what is the possibility of permanent damage? I mean, these refineries have been built, we would think, to withstand a hurricane, but is this hurricane different?
Well, this hurricane is a little bit different, and that's our big concern. It's rare that you get permanent damage caused to a refinery. We probably are going to have more substantial damage to producing rigs that are offshore, maybe pipelines because of what we've seen here.
And what percentage of U.S. oil and gas comes from this region?
About 40% of our supply of crude oil comes from the region, but a disproportionately high percentage of our refineries are down there. And again, we've got about 1.8 million barrels a day of supply that right now has been shut down on a precautionary basis. We have about 15.5 million barrels of refining capacity.
Right, and as you've been saying, it's not maybe the availability of crude oil, but the production of gas from that crude oil that's been the biggest issue in the U.S. anyway, before this storm.
Yes.
Last September, did Ivan have this kind of impact?
Well, Ivan was not as severe a storm, but it had a very long-lasting impact, and it was with us for a prolonged period of time. And that is one of the reasons that we're scared. Through this entire summer, analysts and traders have been talking, and the one thing we've said between ourselves back and forth is the one thing we don't need is another Ivan. Well, we've gotten another Ivan, and instead of it being a Category 3, it's a Category 5.
Right. It's been going from 5 to 4 over the course of the day, still much higher than a 3. Well, you just mentioned that there might be 20 cents added to the price of gas before this weekend. That's adding to the $500 million more a day that Americans are spending than they were 3 years ago on gas?
That's true. And this 20 cents, if it sticks, we'll take $80 million a day out of the American consumers' pockets. We're spending about $360 million a day, more than we were just 1 year ago, and close to $500 million a day, each and every day, more than we were 3 years ago.
And what impact do you see that having on the larger U.S. economy? Obviously, this storm is going to devastate this region, but...
Well, I think it's already started to show up. I think that the people in the 16 to 25 age bracket have been eating out less recently. I think they've been going to fewer movies. I think that's why movie going is down. I think that Walmart has started to see it affect some of its customers.
Mm-hmm. People not wanting to drive to Walmart.
Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to see seniors experience some pain. There's a limit as to how many millions of dollars you can take out of the consumer's pockets each and every day before it starts to show up somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter Boutelle, it would seem to be a mistake to think that this storm, Katrina, is just affecting people in the Mississippi-Louisiana area.
Absolutely. I mean, this storm, while obviously they're experiencing the brunt of the human tragedy, there are consequences for all of us here in the greater United States.
Peter Boutelle, the president of the energy risk management firm Cameron Hanover. And when we spoke earlier today, Hurricane Katrina had just been downgraded from a 5 to a Category 4 storm. It's since been downgraded to a Category 3. And this other update, President Bush is expected to announce a loan of oil from the nation's Strategic Oil Reserve within the next 24 to 48 hours to deal with the effects of Katrina. The reserve was established to cushion oil markets during energy disruptions. The last time President Bush authorized a loan was September 2004, when Hurricane Ivan struck the Gulf. Katrina has already brought a shutdown of an estimated 1 million barrels of refining capacity along the Gulf Coast. Stay tuned to your public radio station. We will keep you updated. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com, and by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.